Bevor es gleich mit der Folge losgeht, auch von meiner Seite, hier ist Christoph, ein ganz, ganz großes Dankeschön an alle, die uns so viele Jahre mit diesem Podcast begleiten. Das sind die Podstars, das Michael bist du natürlich auch, viele andere, die ich jetzt nicht einzeln aufzählen kann, mein Team bei Blackboard. Es ist eine unfassbare Reise und ich bin sehr dankbar dafür. Und es gibt auch wirklich konkret sehr viel, was in den letzten 4 Jahren passiert ist. Als Michael und ich in New York waren, hatte ich ja eben Fragen, wie es bei mir in der Firma weitergeht. Und mittlerweile ist Blackboard, das ist ja nun mal meine Firma, die in der Zwischenzeit auch sehr gewachsen ist, habe ich ihn gefragt, Mensch, in welche Richtung? Und wir haben heute einen ganz klaren Fokus auf alles, was Zusammenarbeit verbessert, alles, was Menschen dabei hilft, besser zusammenzuarbeiten. Und das beginnt bei den Tools, bei den Cloud-Tools, die ihr von uns kennt, geht aber bis hin zum Arbeitsraum, in dem Menschen arbeiten. Und ein ganz großes Thema, was für uns auch immer dazu gehört, ist die Medienkompetenz. Also wie kann ich intern, wenn ich ein Change-Programm habe oder wenn ich einfach nur intern kommunizieren möchte oder vielleicht auch nach extern einen Podcast, wie kann ich ein Team aufbauen, was es beherrscht, diese Medien selber umzusetzen, sprich Videoproduktion intern, eigene Streams auf die Beine zu stellen, vielleicht aber auch Vorträge über Videokonferenz-Tools in hochwertiger Qualität zu übertragen, statt einfach nur Folien abzuspielen, einen eigenen Podcast entwickeln. Also diese Kompetenz, wie kann ich die ins Team bringen? Und das machen wir mit dem Content Creation Programm bei Blackboard. Da bekommt ihr aus unserem Content-Team jemanden an die Hand, die in Workshop-Formaten euch das beibringen, wirklich hands-on, völlig egal, ob virtuell oder vor Ort, und dann auch mit euch das durchbegleiten und aufbauen. Das ist das Content-Creation-Programm, also wenn ihr selber Videos umsetzen wollt, Streams oder Podcasts oder eben einfach nur tatsächlich sagt, wir wollen ein Team aufbauen, was das Ganze beherrscht, die ganze Klaviatur, dann ist das Content-Creation-Programm das Richtige für euch, von klein bis groß. Und das findet ihr auf unserer Website blackboard.com, beziehungsweise ihr braucht da gar nicht lang wühlen. Wenn ihr sagt, das ist was für euch, geht einfach auf blackboard.com, da ist ein Button, um eine WhatsApp-Nachricht zu schicken oder unten eine E-Mail, und dann hört ihr schnellstmöglich von uns zurück. So, genug erzählt. Jetzt viel Spaß mit der neuen Folge.
Our guest today is the Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at the Harvard Business School. The university website describes her institute as a chair established to support the study of human interactions that lead to the creation of successful enterprises that contribute to the betterment of society. She's regularly mentioned in the media. For example, she was ranked on the 3rd place in 2019 by the biannual Thinkers 50 Global Ranking of Management Thinkers, a famous list where you can find her name in every edition since 2011. Her most recent book, The Fearless Organization, Creating Psychological Safety in the Workplace for Learning, Innovation and Growth, has just been published in Germany under the title Die angstfreie Organisation, wie sie psychologische Sicherheit am Arbeitsplatz für mehr Entwicklung, Lernen und Innovation schaffen. She has a calendar that will be filled well into next year, and we are incredibly grateful that she gives us and our podcast listeners the honor of being the last guest in our anniversary week.
Since 4 years, we are on our way to new work. How can a topic that plays such an important part in our everyday life create more meaning in our lives again? How do we get people to draw strength and motivation from their daily work again? How can one succeed in living a happy, healthy, productive and fulfilling life even in such difficult times? And what role do teams and leadership play in this? We are looking for methods, role models, experiences, tools and ideas that bring us closer to the core of new work. We are always concerned with the question of whether everyone can really find and live what they really want in their innermost being. How can we make sure that each and every one of us will find their inner driving force? You are at On the Way to New Work today with Amy Edmondson.
Hello, Amy.
Welcome.
Thank you.
We're so happy to have you, as we already said twice before we started the record and in our introduction. And we always have the same big question when we start the conversation with our guests, which is, how did you become the person you are today?
It's an awfully big question. And I decided not to script it out, but just to just to try to do my best. And I think the most appropriate, most accurate answer is the role that Buckminster Fuller played in my life. So I was in college in the United States and studying engineering. My heart wasn't entirely in it, I have to say. I was in theory good at it, but I didn't have a sense of passion about it. During my studies, I had the chance to hear Buckminster Fuller give a lecture down the road at MIT. I was at Harvard, and I was absolutely inspired. I was mesmerized. Here was this old man, he was in his early 80s at the time, talking about how we humans are here on Earth to solve problems, to take care of lives, to take care of forward lives. He talked passionately about using our best minds, not for weaponry, but for livingry. This was, of course, still in the Cold War. And he introduced a philosophy of design science that was all about working together to make a better world. And that made so much sense to me, and it reinvigorated me. It made me think my studies had more meaning. So a couple of years later, when I was getting ready to graduate, I wrote him a letter. I didn't think I'd hear back. I thought he's very famous. At the time, he was an incredibly famous living person. And so I didn't expect to hear back, but I did think the very act of writing would get this off my chest, right? That then I could get serious about looking for a job once I'd gotten this off my chest. So I wrote him a letter essentially describing my studies a little bit, which centrally included some of his more technical work, but asking for advice, just asking for advice on what someone like me who wanted to make a difference could do. And in less than a week, I had a letter back. This is no email back then, of course. This is just letters in the mail. And I had a letter back that was quite vague, but quite wonderful. It said, please come work for me in my Philadelphia office. And he signed it, I am busier and busier with ever more relevant affairs, warmly, faithfully, Buckminster Fuller. So this is a dream come true. And wow. The best thing I can say about it is that 3 years later, as I worked for him as his chief engineer for those 3 years, I was not disillusioned.
Wow. It's the same that I experienced with you when I wrote you. I did not expect to get anything, but I said, I have to try this. And I think some hours later, he said, wow, what a nice list. I want to be on this list, but I don't have time for it. So let's do it next year. So, yeah. But this is an amazing story. And this was probably the something where you then decided to do a different type of master degree in psychology, or you finished
right.
already
well,
your master?
No, I had not. In fact, mm-hmm. I just finished my undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I worked in an engineering capacity for Fuller. And at the same time, he was a very big thinker, you know, who thought about large scale social systems. And you know, he wanted to reinvent how the world worked, which is, of course, a little too ambitious for anyone. But it spoiled me in a way. It spoiled me for engineering. And also, I don't think it was clear to me I wasn't as good technically as I was conceptually. I got very interested in the larger problems of people working together to get hard things done. And so when that work ended, and it ended when Fuller died, very suddenly, really, at the age of 88, he died at his wife's deathbed. But it was, which was shocking and very, I was very full of grief at the time, but it still quite quickly became, I was more, you know, more aware of my privilege and humility of having had that opportunity, which really was quite inspiring. And so what I thought I should do then was give back in a small way. And to do that, I, I decided I would write a book about his technical work, not about his life. That would have been much too challenging. But to write a book to clarify, he had two big volumes called Synergetics, Synergetics 1 and 2, The Structure of Ordered Space, which were quite daunting to read for most people. But Bucky in person was so compelling. So I wrote a book. And what that did, and in order to support myself while doing that, I would teach workshops and teach courses in universities when someone was on leave. And so I learned that the rhythm of spending a lot of time alone and writing, but coming out now and then to try to explain what I was writing, was a good rhythm for me. And I also thought my true calling, or at least the questions I should answer, weren't so much technical questions as questions of human interaction. So I then, after that process of solo work, I got a job in an organization development boutique consulting company with a wonderful pioneering entrepreneur named Larry Wilson. And that was the work, and I was there for a little over 3 years, and that was the work that opened my eyes to organizational behavior and organizational development. I just didn't know. I didn't know of those as fields. I didn't know what we knew about those kinds of questions or what still needed to be known. So that was very, very new. And after a couple of years there, I thought, I need to go to graduate school. And I had not planned to go to graduate school, but I realized my ignorance. And so applied to PhD programs with very little real understanding of what that meant or what that training was good for. But I did, I'm fortunate that worked out. Because then I did find my calling, which was to be a teacher and a researcher, and to look at the problems of human interactions that contribute to the functioning of organizations and hence of society.
Is there a moment you can recall and remember? Because, like, following you when you share that, it's clearly visible how much you love the space that you're in, and if one could see that now, like how you look and how bright you look, and share that. Is there a moment you remember during that time? Because for someone who's not in that field, it could be that's a wide field, but there are very specific things that you, I guess, research and look at.
Do you mean, Christoph, after I went back to school, or while I was discovering?
Even like when you shared, like working in the consultancy, saying working on projects, working on problems, because sometimes these fascinating moments lay beneath this stress and a lot of project management, but there are moments where you say, this is why I love it. And is there
absolutely
things you can recall?
I mean, there were many of those small moments, and they probably a typical one would be listening to Larry Wilson talk to, let's say, a group of executives, let's say from a global industrial company of some kind, and listening to him effortlessly engage them in a conversation about the deep questions: who are you and why are you here? Right, to understand that a business leader could talk to other business leaders and tell them that these were the important questions that they needed to answer for themselves if they were going to be any good to anyone else. And watching him, maybe early on, I would say, get away with that, right? Get away with asking business leaders what their sense of purpose was. I was stunned by that. My priors were related to business, where that was, you know, business was not something where people talked this way, where people thought this way. And so that's one where I realized that we could have these kinds of conversations and that they mattered deeply in helping those organizations both be good places to work and function for customers the way they should. And possibly the other moment was, and I do remember this well, and I, as I said, I had quite a naive and almost outsider's view of companies. When I grew up in New York City, so we didn't, in my family, we didn't have a car. So I'm not a car person. I had, apologies to your listeners who are car people.
No problem.
I know there are many. The job that I had just taken, Bucky Fuller's office was in Philadelphia. So that was, I didn't need a car, just a bicycle. But I, this job I took with Larry Wilson was in New Mexico, which is quite rural. There's a beautiful town, Santa Fe, where we lived, but everything is quite spread out. So you need a car. So I had to buy a car. And so I did my little bit of research and I bought a Toyota Tercel. It's not on the market in the US anymore, but it was the least expensive Toyota you could buy, and even less than the least expensive Honda you could buy. And this was 1987. It was a very good little car, you know, a beautiful, reliable little car that didn't break down. And, you know, of course not, right? Nowadays, we take that for granted. But so then I, you know, in doing my research, I realized that people were not as happy, and the reliability of some of the big three U.S. Companies was nowhere near the reliability of this less expensive, magnificent, gas-efficient little vehicle that I had just bought. So my priors were that the people who worked in the U.S. automotive companies must not be very bright. Because anybody could see, even a non-expert like me, could easily see that this Toyota was the kind of car that people would want to buy. And so the big aha moment was when then we were working with one of these companies, and I'm meeting these absolutely thoughtful, smart executives who absolutely understood what I understood. They understood what was wrong with their cars, they understood what was wrong with their organization. They couldn't fix it, right? They didn't know how to fix it. It's large, it's complicated, it's embedded. And to me, the aha moment was individuals are very good at learning and at understanding and sizing up what's going on, but companies are really bad at it, right? Organizations, especially big embedded complex organizations, are not good at learning. And so this was in a way a motivation and an inspiration to try to understand why that is and what we could do about it.
What role plays Michael and I are currently thinking on a book chapter writing about learning and discuss the topic about learning attitude. And it came to a podcast we recorded a couple of years ago with Microsoft, who actually reflect as themselves saying, we got to change from a knowing organization, like a know-it-all attitude, to a learning organization. Does it resonate with you? And like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, that's it in a nutshell. That's exactly, that was the, well, that was part of the inspiration for me. And Peter Senge's book came out around that time in 1990 or so, right before, just as I was starting graduate school. But I had met Peter before that, and his book was called The Fifth Discipline, and it was the, you know, the art and science of the learning organization, or something close to that title. And so, yes, it's we as humans are, in fact, I like to say that the basic human challenge is it's hard to learn if you already know. And we are both hardwired and socialized to know, right? To have the feeling of knowing, to have the feeling that I see reality clearly in all its glory. And you probably do too, until we disagree on something. And then I immediately attribute the shortcoming to you. So in other words, we need to actively convert to a mindset of learning.
I would love to make a step into your phase as a researcher at Harvard and during your PhD. In your recent book, you describe the situation when you had a look on your data. You were analyzing, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were analyzing team performance in the context of hospitals, medicine people. And maybe you describe what you found out there, because this was a mind-blowing moment for me when I read this in your book.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. It was mind-blowing for me as well, but I lived through it. So why I'm glad is especially that it came through off the page.
And absolutely.
You understood, in a sense, the suspense, the shock. So what happened was, I was in my first year of graduate school, I was invited to be part of a larger interdisciplinary group of researchers looking at the incidence of medication errors in hospitals. And I was happy to join that project because, as you know, I was interested in learning organizations. And one of the things that you have to be interested in if you're interested in learning organizations is learning from mistakes. So I wasn't quite sure how it would work out, but I figured if there were going to be trained medical investigators identifying mistakes, that could only be good for my learning. And so the part of the study that I was asked to lead was the part that, following on prior research in aviation, where they had discovered in the late 70s and early 80s that many fatal airline crashes had come from essentially team malfunctions in the cockpit. So the simple hypothesis guiding my part of the study was that better teams, better teamwork, and I would use a well-validated survey instrument to look at this, better teams will have lower error rates, right? They will make fewer errors because their coordination will be higher quality, and they will catch and correct things that go wrong, and the patients will be better off as a result. So that was my hypothesis. And here's the moment of surprise and disappointment and even fear, because when I finally got the data from the error rate, so I got the survey data in month one, and the medical investigators tracked what they could on the error rates over 6 months. So when I finally got both data sets and could put them together, at first glance, I was excited because I had a statistically significant relationship between quality of teamwork and error rates. And then I looked again and realized, to my horror, that the correlation was in the wrong direction, meaning the data were suggesting that better teams didn't have lower error rates. They had higher error rates, which was shocking and problematic. And I didn't know initially quite what to do about that. I, of course, looked through to find out, where did I make a mistake? How did I get this wrong in terms of entering data and so forth? None of that. So I was then struck by a kind of blinding flash of the obvious, which was maybe the better teams don't make more mistakes. Maybe they're more willing to report and talk about them. They sort of understand better that the sooner these things come to light, the quicker you catch, correct, and the better off the patients will be. So that became my new hypothesis, and that launched, you know, a new stage of the research to try to see whether that might be right or not. I couldn't just assume it was right by having that thought. It had to be tested. But that was the first of all, it was a surprise. It was a kind of a failure in the first place that led to a success, because what I began to suspect was that what I then called the interpersonal climate across groups, across teams, even in the same organizational context, right, the same strong organizational context, that there could be real differences, you know, palpable differences in interpersonal climate. And later I called that psychological safety, where people would have just an easier time of it in some teams than others, and speaking up and bringing their voice forward.
What were typical examples to make sure you actually grow in psychological safety, like leader-wise, but also like setting the right framework in a company before COVID? And now after over the distance?
Well, it's an interesting topic. It's an important question. So before COVID, and before any of us even saw it coming, psychological safety, we conceptualized it much more as a physical face-to-face phenomenon where we work together. Say I'm in a team and that team shows up in the workplace and the things we do require us to interact, require us to talk to each other. And psychological safety is essentially the shared belief, and it does tend to be, according to the data, does tend to be pretty highly shared in a team. So it's not a personality difference, right? It's something, it's an emergent property of the team. And it, it we tend to think of it as, you know, can I speak up right here, right now? It's a belief that I won't be penalized for making a mistake or for offering a half-baked idea or for expressing a concern about a proposed plan of action. And indeed, it's measurable. It's the survey date. The survey variable has been widely used, and it's predictive of learning behavior and performance, team performance. But now, working remotely, it's the same concept, really. Do I feel able to express myself, to speak up, to offer my ideas? And it's taken a hit, right? I think on average, most people working remotely will experience themselves as having slightly less psychological safety or less easy ability to just chime in with what they know. I think the video technologies like we're using right now can be, I've got to unmute myself. I've got to raise my hand. I've got to try to read the moment where there's a opening for my voice. And it's trickier for people, which means we need to work harder to create it. So I used to say, the things I could talk about that I'd say these good things to do to create psychological safety in the face-to-face environment, they're basically the same, but probably more overtly, more explicitly. It's going to take a little bit more attention to make it happen.
And we don't have these unplanned moments anymore where we just bump into each other. I just realized it because Michael and I, we meet for the podcast, but I just realized in that second when I thought like, what happened actually during this weekend? What did Michael do? And we just had a little bit of WhatsApp conversation, but no space to clean up stuff in between because we just meet for the video conference. So I'm curious about how this space changed.
No, in fact, I think the purpose of an office, really, the purpose of co-location is to enable unscripted coordination and unscripted conversations so much of what many of us do at work is not conducive to scheduling a meeting to do that. Because it won't take an hour and it won't necessarily be clear well in advance when that conversation should take place. So now we're trying, I think we're artificially finding ourselves having to have a lot of meetings that we wouldn't necessarily have had before. And then even then not to be able to have that natural effortless interaction, especially once you have more than five people on a screen, it gets more awkward.
A couple of weeks ago, we had a colleague of you from Harvard Medical School, Robert Waldinger, who told us that he was for almost 1 year not on campus, that he was working totally remotely. And I said, well, he's a psychologist. How can this happen? How can this work? What is with your working style? Are you at home the whole time or are you on campus?
Well, in the spring, last spring, from mid-March onward, I was completely at home. I would occasionally go in to get something, a folder I needed or something from my office. And my office is only a mile away from my home, so it's pretty easy. And all the precautions. In fact, when I first went in, my husband, who's a physician, was very, you know, oh, you can't do that. It's going to be unsafe. You know, we now know it's not hovering on surfaces and door handles so much. But as this year went on, I would spend more time in the office than before. But it's very lonely there. There's nobody there. And then this spring, from late January onward, I was teaching at Harvard in our hybrid mode, which meant instead of having 72 students in a classroom with me, I had 25 in a classroom with me in a very, very big classroom, all 6 feet apart, all with masks, including me, and the other 50 some on Zoom coming in. So believe it or not, as awkward as that is, it's still better than having just Zoom and all 72, because at least there's some sense of the human interaction, of the body language, of the we can hear each other, and they rotated through, most of them. So, yeah, as a psychologist, you know, certainly a great deal of my work is solo work, or you know, I'm writing things, and I might be writing with a co-author, but we're sending them back and forth anyway. That's what we would have done before the pandemic, that's what we're still doing. But teaching, I feel it immensely, and planning for teaching. Often a few colleagues come together to brainstorm a teaching plan. I mean, how will we teach this material? And those are very engaging and energizing kinds of meetings, and doing those on Zoom is not quite as good.
Und bevor es gleich mit dem Podcast weitergeht, ein großes Dankeschön und ein kleines Stück Werbung in eigener Sache. Christoph hat es neulich schon angesprochen, unsere Freunde von 2Musik, Simon und Christian, wir hatten sie beide bei uns schon im Podcast. Die beiden machen mit ihrer Company Musik für Werbeclips, sie machen aber auch Musik für Hollywood-Trailer und für Spiele. Und sie entwickeln eigene Künstler, wie zum Beispiel Orang-Utan mit What's Your Love. Und dieses neue Stück, was ihr auch in einem ganz tollen Clip auf YouTube anschauen könnt, ist unsere neue Musik. Auch die Musik davor war schon von 2Musik. Und ein ganz, ganz großes Dankeschön geht an die beiden und ihr fantastisches Team. Und nochmal der Hinweis, dass ich jetzt mit meiner neuen Firma, der NWMS GmbH, das New Work Master Skills Executive Programm launche, zusammen mit meiner Geschäftspartnerin Svantje Almas, haben wir dieses einjährige Programm konzipiert. Wir kombinieren dabei spannende Methoden zur persönlichen Stärkung und Weiterentwicklung mit einem Deep Dive rund um neues Arbeiten, Teamtools und dem Anspruch, dort auch einen gesellschaftlichen Impact zu erzielen. Wir fassen es so zusammen, Better Me, Better We, Better Society. Und das Ganze ist eine Mischung aus Theorie und Praxis, gemeinsame Arbeitsblöcke. 4x3 Tage treffen wir uns bei mir in meinem Work-Life-Space hier in Hamburg. Es gibt dazwischen 1-zu-1-Coaching, aber auch Peer-to-Peer-Coaching. Wir haben Profiling-Tools, vieles andere mehr. Und wir, Svanti und ich, begleiten es das ganze Jahr, aber wir werden unterstützt von 15 Expertinnen und Experten, darunter Weltklasse, Sportler und Trainer, Unternehmer, Medienpersönlichkeiten, Mediziner, Executive Recovery Coaches, Schauspieler, Medientrainer und auch der Einblick in Konzerne wird durch einen ehemaligen Vorstandsmitglied uns dort gegeben. Und ja, jetzt anmelden. Wir haben nur 15 Plätze. Die ersten Anmeldungen sind schon eingetrudelt. Beginn ist im September 2021. Alle Infos dazu findet ihr auf www.newworkmasterskills.com. Dort könnt ihr auch dann per Mail Fragen stellen, wenn euch das nicht genug Infos sind. Vielen Dank und weiter geht's mit Amy Edmondson. What we learned from some entrepreneurs is that they have the feeling that some of their people work even harder during pandemic, taking the risk of getting a burnout. Others, sometimes people who are more silent, are getting shyer and shyer over the period. They switch off their video function in team meetings and you don't see and feel them anymore. And then there is the third group of people who started to self-optimize them, do more sports, learn a new language. So we have so many different effects the pandemic is having on us, and we have totally different circumstances, like homeschooling with 3 kids in a small flat versus someone living just with in a couple and lots of space. So what do you think will be, what do we have to do as leaders in the next weeks to come to bring this together again into a structure which is more normal? And how do we find out?
It's true. What you describe is something of a we're creating more differences rather than coming together, and that may, depending on the work that the organization does, that may be a real barrier to excellence. But I, to answer your question, I think you start with the goal. You start with the purpose. You start with what is it we do, right? What is the value we add for our customers, for our communities? You know, we exist. Our organization exists to serve some purpose, and let's get crystal clear about what that purpose is, and then, and that shouldn't take too long because you already have that, presumably. But then it's okay, what does it take to best deliver on that purpose, right? How do you best deliver that kind of value? And the answer to that question will differ depending on what the nature of the value is. Does it involve a mass production facility that needs to be operating at a high level of excellence and quality? Does it involve small little innovation teams coming up with, new things for customers that they, whatever, right? Whatever it is, but let the answer to that question drive the decisions we make going forward. And by decisions, I mean the design decisions. I think of the future of work and the future of the workplace as a big design problem, right? And it should be designed not as much as I have my preferences and you have your preferences. Those shouldn't be the design factors. We exist to serve. So mm-hmm. let that be the driving factors in what we need to do. How often do we need to be together, and how do we need to be together? And how much of our work is truly can be solo work, which where you can do it anywhere, and how much time is left over to do those other things you want to do.
During this time, it feels like that the leadership styles are amplified by COVID. And you had in one of the videos I saw, very good videos, by the way, I saw with extremely good energy, and I can highly recommend watching your videos. You had the example of Jacinda Ardern, New Zealand's yes. prime minister, and she is, I think, 2 years older than I am, as I consider myself very young. She's still very young.
You are. She's very young.
Some say so. But you had her as an example of a leader who is brave enough to say, I don't know. And I don't know is an answer as well. And this is one extreme of leaders during this time. And we have other worse extremes of leaders doing crazy things at the moment, it seems like. Does mm-hmm. this whole phase we're going through amplify these styles and actually bringing us to showing these limits? Like, what is happening here? And help us to find the right direction.
That is a really good question. And my guess is yes. But I think that the statement implied in the question is probably an accurate one. I haven't thought about it before. But we've certainly, maybe it's because we're cooped up and we're paying more attention and maybe consuming more news during this time. It's created, maybe it's our very attention that has fed the amplification. I don't know. But I do think it's the case that during this period, we've seen some extreme examples of toxic leadership. And by toxic, I primarily mean leadership that is clearly not dedicated to the greater good, mm-hmm. right? but more dedicated to the project of me, my own glory, my own self-aggrandizement. And anytime a leader is about just about himself or herself versus about the community that they lead, that they serve, it shows, right? And maybe now we're seeing it in more amplified ways. But I do, it's worth adding on to the Prime Minister Ardern model isn't just about saying, I don't know. There's a willingness to say, I don't know, because that's truthful. So but the bigger formula is one of transparency, both about what you don't know, but importantly about what you do know, and maybe some clarity or heads up about what we're doing to learn more, or what we're doing to react to the things we do know, and a willingness to ask people to do things that are hard. But I think that's an important aspect of leadership. And, you know, any leader who sells you a vision that says, relax, enjoy yourself, you don't have to do anything, you know, just keep me in power here and I'll be, you know, you'll be fine, is a leader you should run away from fast. Right? Because the things that we need to do collectively to take care of each other are going to be hard. They are hard. And we'll all have to do our part. And that will mean different things depending on your skills and experiences and situations.
In your work of the last years, you became, I think, the world leading expert for teams and teaming. And you describe in your work that there is a difference between a high-performance sport team, which is where every member is 24/7 member of this team, and this is their only job, versus teams and organizations where the teamwork is part of the work, but it's not the 24/7 thing, and that we have to see the difference. Can you say a little bit about about team? How do we team people?
Yeah, let me describe that. In my book Teaming, I was explicitly making a distinction between the activities of teamwork and the noun team. And because in many organizations that I've studied, teams were getting more and more fluid in their membership. So the traditional definition of a team, and a sports team, of course, exemplifies this definition, is a bounded group. You know if you're on it or not, that's clear cut, who are interdependent in achieving a shared goal. So again, a sports team is just the exemplifies that definition. You know if you're on the team or not. The clear goal, you know, win a game, win a championship, is understood by all. And because of that continuity of working together over a pretty long time, they get to know each other's strengths and weaknesses. And some of the coordination can be just magical, effortless. And the same is true in a knowledge work team that works together over some period of time. We know what what your background is, what your skills are, what you're good at, and we are good at coordinating. Now, that makes it sound like you should always have stable teams, and you should when the work allows it or demands it. But the challenge is, and the reality is, that more and more of the work requires us to coordinate and collaborate with different people at different times. Complex projects have a need for one type of expertise at time one, and they need a different type of expertise at time two. So we have to get good at teaming. We have to get good at coordinating and collaborating with different people at different times. So it means we have to get up to speed quickly. You know, who are you? What do you bring? You know, what are you up against? And by the way, let me tell you that about me as well. And then we will figure out quickly, sort of a problem to be solved, how to work together effectively. But we can't rely on just familiarity, you know, just you're my group, you're not, to help us do that. So we need to learn new skills for effective interaction.
Is again a good thing we do at the moment when I think about that. I mean, because so many people are pushed out of their comfort zones, seeing, okay, what is the limit? How do I do it different? And it's interesting to see how people react to that. Would be my question, like, what are toxic behaviors in teams that help you to detect and say, hey, this is like in not criticizing the person, how we react, but criticizing the action, saying, okay, I like you as a person, but the way you act is not right. Good or is toxic to the project and especially to the team. What is that?
Well, it's really about helping people understand the impact they're having. I think nearly everybody cares about the impact they have on others, right? Maybe, you know, if you're a sociopath, you don't. But nearly everybody cares very much. They want to have a positive impact. Unfortunately, they might be missing the tools to do that. Right? Mm. So their domineering behavior. They're trying to show how smart they are so that others will admire them. But what they've done instead is alienate people and let other people feel, well, I'm not going to speak up because this guy doesn't listen anyway. Mm. So what we always have, I think, an obligation to help people understand the actual impact they're having and to help them try out some new approaches that might have a more favorable impact. And sometimes that's harder than others. Sometimes people, they just weren't aware, right? They were blind. And other times they just have a harder time moving on from the kinds of behaviors that are toxic in the group, you know, doing all the talking, putting people down, making fun of people for having the wrong answer or any of those kinds of things, which if you think about it, are at a kind of a lower level of personal development or personal growth than is optimal for collaborative work.
Do you see differences in the size of companies? Is this something you see more often in big corporations than in startups or mid-sized companies, or is this universal and feminine?
Well, I don't have any systematic data on company size. I think what I can say for sure is that in any large company, there's variability. There's going to be pockets of just great teamwork and great collaboration, and then pockets of poor teamwork, and that's often because there's very much I'll call it, for lack of a better term, a middle management effect. I mean, the skills of those new and then, you know, depending on how many levels you have, but the newer managers or the managers with layers above them and layers below them, those skills vary a lot. And those people get promoted to management roles, not always for the right reasons. And then that can, you know, that can have a real impact. But certainly, you know, a startup that is passionate about its value proposition and has maybe brought together a group of people who are equally so, you're generally going to have a pretty healthy learning, problem-solving culture present because of the life stage of the organization. But we've also seen, you know, startups that are toxic and some famously so, that don't allow dissenting views, don't allow the reporting of bad news and all the rest. When things work, sometimes it takes longer for them to work. Those companies do get, you know, they get in trouble eventually. Mm-hmm. They don't make it.
In your book, The Fearless Organization, you have many examples of companies who failed or organizations who failed. Do you have some positive examples where you say, well, there are some companies I've seen where there are extremely good leaders, extremely good tools to team up?
Yes. And I'll reemphasize that it's always a risky business to say, here's a company, right? Okay. Here's a company that's doing it right. Because again, tomorrow there'll be headlines, right, about that company. But, and that's one, and because these are dynamic entities looked at a moment in time. Mm-hmm. And also because any company of any, you know, of good size that isn't just a team is going to have pockets, is often going to have pockets of better and worse. But I tried in the chapters on the sort of the stories that describe the cases that describe how and why the creation of a real learning climate of psychological safety and speaking up how and why that connects to good performance in a bunch of different industries. But I want to say, because other, you know, it's easy to come up with the more creative industries, you know, the famous cases like IDEO, a well-known innovation consultancy. It's just full of good humor and voice, and it's fine to speak up with a crazy idea, and it's fine to have failures because that's required for innovation. Or one of my favorite examples, and it's in the book, is Pixar, which is famously able to produce commercial and critical success film one after another, right? Mm-hmm. That just doesn't happen in the entertainment industry. You have a hit, and then you have a clunker, and then their ability to sort of consistently be innovative and creative and produce these very successful products is quite impressive. So if you take a deep dive in and look at how they do that, central to that process, to that ability, is a psychologically safe environment where people will critique openly the emerging scenes for being dull or not very good yet or not interesting. They'll experiment with crazy ideas. They'll tolerate failures in the process before they come together. We don't want to tolerate a failure in the theater. We want to tolerate failures so we don't produce them in the theater. And they go out of their way, both from the sort of leadership example set by Ed Catmull to the way they train and help teams be candid and willing to do this hard stuff, right? This is for human beings, this is hard. And so that's a good example. But then they're making movies, that's sort of fun and sure, easy for them. So then I'll take you to Barry Waymiller, an industrial products company. You know, they have machinists and they're making really tangible, high quality, sort of customized equipment for other manufacturers. And they have managed to create an enormously self-managed, candid, open culture of caring, of commitment to the products, of using everyone's intelligence and expertise to do the very best they can for the business and for the customers.
Yeah, two good examples, and I especially like the Pixar example because they created tools like this feedback tool where they really make sure that any team which has the freedom to do the film like they ever want to do it, but they have to show it at a certain point of the production. They have to show it to a group of people who are not involved, and they have to give their honest feedback they can. And to be open to receive this feedback and to give this feedback, I think you have to train this, and you have to have tools or processes to make sure that everyone can adapt this. Yeah.
You talked about shared leadership. I think, I don't know if it was an article or a video, but I stumbled upon sharing leadership in a way and how important it is. And it feels counterintuitive looking into organizations that are very successful. Let's take Apple, for example, when people think like, oh, it was Steve Jobs. And now it's like Apple has like one CEO and everyone around them. But can you explore a little bit on like why it's so important and where we do see examples to like, also show people that this is a good path to go? And I know personally for myself, I have hard times sharing that. I know it's good doing it and I see the good results, but it takes some kind of moments where I say, okay, now do it. And like grow with that. And like, I mean that without reflecting about it, doing it in everyday business.
Yeah, maybe I think it's helpful to distinguish between leader and leadership. Mm-hmm. So you can be enthusiastic about having a leader for a project or a company. And let's hope that we could talk about what kind of leader is going to be the best kind of leader for that company. We have very few companies. I can't think of any really that would work, where a Henry Ford model of leadership would work anymore, right? Henry's got all the answers. You've got scientific management. It's going to be, and you're just going to do what you're told precisely, right? It's hard to think of that model working well in too many industries today. So you can have a leader, but if that leader isn't creating the conditions whereby others can exercise leadership, which I will define as doing and saying things that make a positive difference, right? And you know, that maybe that influence others, their colleagues, sometimes their superiors, sometimes their direct reports, but the creating the conditions where people can exercise leadership in today's knowledge-intensive workplaces is critical, because that's, first of all, that's satisfying for people. I mean, people want to feel they made a difference. And by exercising leadership, that can be anything from just making a coworker feel more connected and a greater sense of belonging to making a critical purchasing decision about a new piece of equipment that's gonna help us do our work better and serve our customers better, right? That's, both of those are acts of leadership, smaller or larger. So that's that. I wanted to start there, and then you know the jobs. The Apple example is often put out as a model of, you know, almost Henry Ford like success model. I think that's wrong for two reasons. One, I think the sort of storied Steve Jobs was clearly a genius, right? But according to Ed Catmull, who worked closely with him, he was not nearly as closed to others' good ideas as some of the stereotypical descriptions were. That in fact he just wanted the data, he wanted evidence. You know, he'd put a high hurdle against the idea that you might be right about something, but he would respect you enough to kind of hear it out. So that's one thing to respond, is that probably some of the stereotypes are overplayed. But here's what is more logical to consider. Like, we don't have with Steve Jobs the counterfactual. Like, we don't have what Apple would look like, or whether they'd have essentially more than five products, you know, had there been even more inclusion, even more empowerment of other activities. Like, we don't have that counterfactual. We just have their extraordinary success doing what they did do, which was very much influenced by Steve. We also don't know, could Apple have not had its near-death, you know, experience? I mean, he certainly, the old Steve versus the new Steve might say, but more to the point, maybe for your listeners and mere mortals like myself, is if you believe you're Steve Jobs and you don't need anyone else's input, you know, I mean, you believe that about yourself, by all means, go to town.
But you better be a genius.
I wouldn't recommend it, right? I would recommend you have, you know. Yeah. Take advantage of the geniuses in your midst, you know, or at least the ideas in your midst. Create the conditions whereby people can speak up and offer their feedback. And you know, Michael mentioned the Pixar, the formal process they have, and they call it the Brain Trust, which I think is a great name. It's not a thing; it's a process. And the process of the Brain Trust is bring your brain in here, and while you're in this meeting, here are the rules, right? All criticism is needed, is welcome. Don't criticize the person, criticize the thing. And on and on it goes. There's rules. And the reason there are rules is that we know that people are, you know, people will slip up and start doing the wrong kinds of attacks. So they need our help.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, I use that example because I was curious about, this is something people can relate to, and I'm always fascinated with the idea, how can a leader leverage that? And even Henry Ford, I would guess, it's such a large organization, some kind of sharing must have been there. And here comes my question when it comes to history. With which leader would you love to spend a day who is not alive anymore, if you could choose? Who would you spend a day with?
Where did you get this question from?
Yeah, I mean, maybe this, I don't know why this just popped to mind, but it did, so I'll share it. Dwight Eisenhower, because he actually was a very good manager, that he was systematic in his, you know, it wasn't all about, it certainly wasn't, you know, a sort of charisma story, but a story of listening deeply to the expertise that other generals had, and also as president, really listening, really processing. I'm sure you know the matrix that has urgency against importance, and that's the Eisenhower matrix. Yeah. So that to me, I would like to know more about, you know, how he thought. To understand deeply that, especially in a world, it was well before everything was urgent, you know, but he was still aware of the trap you can fall into when you let the urgent drive out the important, and likely fail to distinguish between the urgent that's important and the urgent that's not so important. Oh. So he comes to mind, but of course, only because I teach management, and I think he was a very good manager. Probably the leader that I would be, I mean, it would be, you know, almost impossible to imagine, because he's probably the greatest leader I can think of. It would be Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. So I guess I seem to be stuck in presidents here today, but but you know, this his writings and the biographies, I mean, he is just a truly rare, you know, he's a rare person who is extraordinarily wise and extraordinarily committed to making a difference and not to himself.
Mm-hmm. I had in Washington D.C. I had the chance to sit at the desk of his weekend house, which is a bit outside of DC, and we had a dinner there, and there was his desk and a very uncomfortable wooden chair, and I sat there and there was a book, and now that you said it, you brought me back to this moment, and I thought, like, how can one person change so many things, looking like, if you look backwards, sitting at this desk and doing some writing, and we sit here with all the technology
and no keyboards, right?
I forgot about this moment. You just brought that back to me, and I think it's fascinating. Going back to that time, looking at that, smell these things, and see that this always happened. This is a tremendous journey you took us on. I could listen to you so for much. At least another hour. I'm just realizing we hit the 1 hour.
So we have some final questions for you. So you already named some books during this fantastic hour we had, but do you have one or two more books which were very inspiring to you?
Yes, that's a great opportunity to answer that question. So one that I found very inspiring and very profound is called Leadership and Self-Deception. And it doesn't even have an author. It's by the Arbinger Institute. And it's a novel, but it's a novel that basically helps people understand the ways we objectify others and privilege ourselves, right? So it's leadership and self-deception. The self-deception is really that we are all deceiving ourselves about our relationships with others. And it makes the argument that real leadership requires us, I think, to drop some of the trappings of ego. So it's very powerful and easy read. It's a very powerful book. To me, it's absolutely consistent with one of my great mentors, Chris Argyris, who's a pioneering thinker and was in thinking about organizational learning and thinking about how we just don't we don't effectively learn from each other because we're so sure we're right. I guess that's the simplest way to say it. So that's one. I very much am moved by Humble Inquiry by Ed Schein, who's just a, you know, a beautiful person and thinker. And Humble Inquiry, it says it all, right? It's start, lead with inquiry, lead with curiosity. Recognize the humility comes from recognizing you don't yet know, right? You don't yet know the answers. By the way, I absolutely loved Reinventing Organizations, and that is very consistent. Right? That the book and the part about the different stages and then how they can be manifested in a much better way to work is absolutely consistent with both of those books. I loved The Culture Code by Dan Coyle. It's a beautiful read. It's a page turner full of great stories of organizations that have understood the power of culture, the secret fuel that a good culture can provide to your company. So it's one of the, I think if people are new to the field of organizational development and they want to understand why culture matters, that's a really good book to start with.
Wow. Before I have the last question, I have a personal question. Is there any executive learning program at Harvard Business School where I could sign in to learn more from you?
Yes. The answer is yes. Although the question we have programs that are customized for different companies, mm-hmm. and then we have open programs. So we're talking about an open program. I taught in one this year. I hope I'll teach in it again on agility, unlocking agility. Wow. And I taught three sessions in it. So that was a lot of fun.
Very cool. So the last question is the bucket list. If you could say, you could name three things. One thing you want to see or want to do. One thing you will have the chance to learn, and the last thing is something you want to give back to society. What would be the three things? Experience, learning, and giving back.
Oh, it's so hard. Those are such hard questions. Let me take the learning one. I would like to relearn and become fluent. I never became fluent, but in French, because it was the only language I ever learned. I was good enough at French to place out, meaning I could pass a test when I showed up at university, so I could place out of the language requirement, which was the stupidest thing I ever did, because I then didn't take any, and that was 1,000 years ago. I badly want to have that capacity to speak a second language, and that's the only one that I think I even have a prayer of. At the moment, I can only think I want to travel again. Yeah. I want to be with people again. I want to be with you.
Plus one.
Yeah. Where you are. I want to go back to Europe. Go somewhere. And give back. I suppose the on my mind is, to give help people figure out a healthier relationship to failure, and a better understanding of the nuances of productive and counterproductive kinds of failure, preventable and unpreventable, discovery versus violation. And that just seems to me a territory that I can contribute to that's not yet done.
Wow. Thank you so much. This was a gift. This was my birthday present for 4 years of On the Way to New World. The final one.
I enjoyed it. I loved talking with both of you.
Very, very nice journey you took us on to. And I'm very honored. And that was kind of a private lesson with you and a gift. And I always tend to forget that this is a podcast, and this is definitely one of these moments where I forgot that. Yep. Thank you so much.
Same with me.
That's a wonderful thing to say.
Bye-bye, Amy. Thank you.
Yeah. Jetzt vor allem, auch wenn ich das da nochmal rein... eine geile Reise, also Wahnsinn, irre, weil sie in einer völligen Ruhe durch diese Leadership-Beispiele gegangen ist und ich das so irre wichtig finde, auch so diese Sachen zu verstehen zwischen Leader und Leadership. Und ich denke immer wieder so, geil, man kann auf diesem Thema oder ich kann auf diesem Thema immer weiter lernen. Das ist, macht so viel Spaß. Und als sie dann das von Abraham Lincoln erzählte, da fiel mir ist es wirklich denn in der Sekunde erst wieder eingefallen, dass wir die Chancen hatten durch I.O., durch dieses Wochenendhaus davon, das Museum, das kann man sich angucken, das ist aber das Haus. Und da war dieser Schreibtisch und dann habe ich mich da rangesetzt, da durfte man sich hinsetzen und sitzt auf diesem super harten Holzstuhl, der war echt scheiße. Und dachte so, Wahnsinn. Und durch ihre Beispiele, muss ich sagen, hat das wieder so eine Demut in mir ausgelöst, welche Verantwortung da eben ist und warum es so wichtig ist, sich gut zu verhalten und warum das nichts mit Selbstoptimierung zu tun hat und dass ich mich auch über viele Menschen ärgere, die da eher so in diese Richtung gehen. Ich aber sage, okay, fang bei dir selber an, verhalte dich gut und bleib auf diesem Weg und wenn du dich so entschieden hast, go for it. Sorry, nee, lange Antwort, aber hat mich sehr bewegt.
Ich kann das nur ergänzen. Ich habe ja durch Zufall in einem Harvard Manager Artikel gelesen, also auch nicht Zufall, es ist eine Leadership-Sammelausgabe gewesen, dann stößt man halt irgendwann auf sie. Und dann diese Beispiele gelesen und habe dann wirklich sofort ihr die Mail geschickt oder LinkedIn-Nachricht und auch über den offiziellen, über Harvard-Adresse. Und kriegte sofort eine Antwort. Und die ist eben so verbindlich und so klar und wollte das ja eigentlich dann nochmal aufs nächste Jahr verschieben, weil sie so viel zu tun hat. Und dann haben wir sie ja irgendwie doch bekniet, es doch zu machen, bevor unser Hammer. Buch kommt. Und ich bin schwer begeistert. Also ich finde es ganz toll. Und
ja, da hast du dich aber auch hart reingekniet. Also das ist wirklich, wie du das so...
Und die Tatsache, dass du jetzt auf Deutsch switcht, obwohl du dich ja in Englisch sehr wohlfühlst, zeigt mir auch nochmal, wie tief sie dich gerade erreicht hat. Und ich finde, wir lassen es jetzt auch ruhig auf Deutsch. Yes. Und jetzt wurde unsere Geburtstagswoche zu Ende ist. Vier großartige Folgen. Ich mache nochmal die Zusammenfassung. Frederic Laloux am Samstag, am Montag Wolf Lotter, dann Mittwoch Insa Klasing und heute am Freitag die wunderbare Amy Edmondson. Also vier tolle Menschen, zwei tolle Frauen, zwei tolle Männer. Wer jetzt mal Lust hat, uns vielleicht auf den Plattformen eine Bewertung zu geben oder mal eine Nachricht zu schreiben, bitte da. Das hilft uns sehr. Wir wollen natürlich gerne weiter wachsen mit dem Podcast und dazu gehört einfach auch die Interaktion auf den Plattformen. So sehr wir uns über die Nachrichten auf LinkedIn freuen, die wir schon bekommen haben, die harte Währung findet bei Spotify und Apple Podcasts statt. Sterne im oberen Bereich gerne dort, die niedrig sind, gerne als direktes Feedback an uns und nette Beurteilungen dort und die kritischen gerne öffentlich auch, aber auf anderen Plattformen.
Hier ist meine Telefonnummer. Tritt,
aber ihr wisst, so geht das Spiel. Vielen Dank für die vier Folgen, Christoph. Diese Woche, diese Extrawoche war deine Idee, das so zu machen. Und
also ganz klar, die Energie zu pushen, die kommt von dir und das geht auf deine Schultern und das ist richtig gut. Danke dir.